The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Time Magazine. Today's program is supported by G. Suggs Insurance, a SureVest insurance group company. They can be reached at gsuggsinsurance.com. That is gsuggsinsurance.com. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the Time edition, dated March 23, 2026. This features on the cover the usual red border with a white inner border. Time is in large block lettering in white, capital lettering that is, superimposed upon a pale grayish, whitish, bluish background. Then centered, the image that is centered in the front of the cover is that of 2, 4, 6, 8 red baseball caps. One says, make Iran great again, make Venezuela great again, make Nigeria great again, make Ecuador great again, make Yemen great again, make Syria great again, make Iraq great again, and make Somalia great again. So beginning with that, the brief, Leaving Their Home, by Rebecca Schneid. A new law in Kansas is forcing trans people to reconsider their futures there. Anthony Alvarez loves Kansas. He moved there when he was 11, and now every single person he cares about and loves is in the Sunflower State, he tells Time. But lately, Alvarez says, he and his friends are thinking of leaving. Alvarez, a 22-year-old who will graduate from University of Kansas this spring, came out as trans 6 years ago and says the average Kansan never bothered him about his gender. On campus, he walks into the men's restroom without hesitation, just another student moving through his day. That calculus is changing, he says. Kansas Republicans in late February overrode the veto of Democratic Governor Laura Kelly to pass one of the most restrictive laws in the country for transgender residents, imposing new limits on bathroom access and identification. I want to give my skills to Kansas. I want to live in the place I have called home for so long, but I cannot stay in a place that's going to be outwardly hostile to me, Alvarez says. Kansas had last year already joined a wave of states legislating against gender-affirming care for minors, prohibition supported by President Donald Trump. The new law, Senate Bill 244, focuses on restricting identification and the use of multiple occupancy private spaces, reviving the debate over bathroom bills that roiled states like North Carolina in 2016. The law goes further than many comparable bills by invalidating licenses and birth certificates that transgender people have updated to reflect their gender identities and names, and by allowing private citizens to file a civil action of up to $1,000 against a person of a different sex if they are aggrieved by an invasion of privacy in some spaces. The new law's bathroom provisions create a bounty hunter regime, says LGBTQ plus rights group Lambda Legal, by effectively allowing people to sue transgender people who use the restroom not aligned with their biological sex. The bill also allows people to be criminally charged with a Class B misdemeanor for repeat violations. Republican lawmakers say the law is aimed at protecting women and girls. While the governor fearmongers and muddies the water with her misleading veto message, our position remains steady. This is not about scoring political points, but doing what's right for women and girls across our communities, State House Speaker Daniel Hawkins said in a statement after the override. The law took effect February 26. Kelly called the legislation poorly drafted, and experts worry the measure's broad language and sweeping changes will have unwanted consequences for anyone who uses public restrooms. Opponents of the bill say it was pushed through with little public input after its bathroom bill provisions were added in late January. The goal is to single out and exclude, if not give a total license to discriminate against, transgender people in the state, says Logan Casey, Director of Policy Research at the Movement Advancement Project, a think tank. He says the law's restroom provision is not just invasive and dangerous, but one of the widest sweeping currently in the nation. While laws in Florida, Tennessee, and Texas also bar changes to gender markers for new driver's licenses, Kansas' reversal of existing documents is unusual. Kansas officials expect to cancel about 1,700 driver's licenses and issue new birth certificates for up to 1,800 people, according to the Kansas Department of Revenue. Alvarez said he's gone through four IDs since 2023 as he navigated different restrictions to get a new gender marker, change his name, and renew his ID after turning 21. Now he expects to be notified by mail that his ID is invalid, meaning a fifth round of paperwork. It's basically outing yourself to like every single person around you. Representative data about trans Americans is historically sparse, but a 2024 survey of 192 respondents in Kansas, run by the Trevor Project, found that 47% of LGBTQ+, 13 to 24-year-olds, reported they or their family had considered leaving because of the state's policies. That figure rose to 56% for trans and non-binary youth. And Tara McKay, director of the LGBTQ+ Policy Lab at Vanderbilt University, points to the U.S. Transgender Survey, billed as the largest survey of transgender people in the country, which in 2022 showed nearly a quarter of respondents reported being verbally harassed, denied benefits and services, or asked to leave establishments when they provided an ID that did not match their presentation. Revoking IDs already issued to folks who have socially transitioned, legally transitioned, possibly medically transitioned, creates a whole new set of problems, McKay says. This is a policy choice that predictably increases harm. Isaac Johnson, a trans man who worked for years as a social worker in Kansas, credits the escalating attacks on transgender people there as his reason for moving 2 months ago to New York. I feel guilty on one hand for leaving Kansas and leaving all my friends behind, he says, but also everyone is fleeing right now. Interview, question and answer. What's new for the Epstein files by Nick Popley, P-O-P-L-I. This is a question and answer format. Representative Ro Khanna helped force one of the most sweeping disclosures of investigative records in modern American history when Congress passed his bipartisan Epstein Files Transparency Act last year, compelling the Justice Department to release millions of documents tied to the convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. The release has triggered a wave of fallout with prominent figures across politics, business, and international institutions resigning or facing investigations. Developments Khanna, and that is spelled K-H-A-N-N-A, describes as the beginning of a long-awaited moral reckoning for what he calls an Epstein class of powerful people who believed themselves beyond accountability. Even though more than 3 million pages have been made public, major questions remain. Lawmakers and journalists have identified millions of additional documents still withheld or heavily redacted including missing FBI interview summaries connected to allegations involving President Donald Trump. Trump has long said he had no knowledge of Epstein's crimes. Why are they hiding these documents, asks Khanna, a Democrat who represents the Silicon Valley area. Time spoke with Khanna about why he believes the most consequential evidence remains hidden and what Congress and the courts could do next to force additional disclosures. Question, are you surprised the files have had an impact across so many countries and industries? Answer, I had to ask someone on my team and GOP Representative Thomas Massey's team to compile the list of rich and powerful people in the United States and around the world that are being held accountable. There are dozens, and there are dozens more who need to be held accountable, and in some cases investigated and prosecuted. I've always said if these files are released, it will be a moral reckoning for the nation, and half of the worst stuff still has not been released. This is the first time in modern American history the global elite are being held accountable. Question, do you expect more people will be implicated? Answer, yes, I believe more people will be implicated in terms of having known about Jeffrey Epstein's pedophilia and turned a blind eye and still having engaged in business relationships with him. I believe some others will be exposed as having raped these young girls and trafficked these young girls. The problem is, though, we need the documents that have not been released. The most central right now are the three documents the FBI and DOJ have covered up with a woman's allegation against Donald Trump that he sexually assaulted her when she was a minor. I have no idea on the merits, but I do believe the problem is the cover-up. March 5, after Khanna spoke to Time, the DOJ released the documents, saying their omission had been an accident. Question, how much of the documents have we not yet seen? Deputy Attorney General Todd Blanche has said there are about 3 million or so documents that have not been released. And of the documents that have been released, there are too many redactions on them, and even the members of Congress are seeing documents that already had been blanked out. Question, what response have you gotten from the DOJ as to why those documents are not available? Answer, they just hide behind privilege, and they claim they're protecting survivors. But they've protected the predators, and they are not complying with the law. Question, what else can Congress do to force the DOJ to release the files? Answer, we can take action in the Southern District of New York to require the release. Survivors can sue to require the release under the Epstein Transparency Act. When Democrats are back in the majority, we can subpoena people at the Justice Department and FBI whistleblowers. And we need to bring in front of our committee those people who are in the files, who've been emailing about going to the island or the ranch, and ask them under oath what they knew. Question, does Congress need a second phase of legislation? Would you change anything in the bill? Answer, we could pass a second law to be even more explicit, but they may just violate the second law. Maybe there's additional punitive teeth we can put on it. Really, we need the judicial system to enforce it. Last question, what has been revealed in the files about Epstein's relationship with President Trump? Answer, they had an extensive friendship, and they spent a fair amount of time together, and there are also, of course, allegations against President Trump by at least one woman. What we need is transparency. I do not judge the merits of any of this, but what we need is President Trump to come before Congress and testify under oath like President Clinton. The View essay, Environment. A river ran through it, America's thirsty West. by Pete McBride. McBride's a photographer and filmmaker and the author of Witness to Water. I have spent most of my life chasing snow and water around the West. I grew up on a cattle ranch in central Colorado, so I learned early on food does not come from the supermarket, and water does not originate at the tap. Melting snow feeds creeks and tributaries that eventually connect with the Colorado River, often described as the most loved and litigated body of water in the West. The icy, crystal-clear snowmelt flows 1,450 miles through seven states and 11 national parks, supporting on the way some 40 million Americans and 4 million acres of farmland. The delta, where it ends in Baja and Sonora, Mexico, was once the largest desert estuary in North America. Boasting so many migratory birds, the sky was often blocked by blankets of wings. Today it's a cracked earth wasteland, more a river cemetery than an oasis. I've been documenting this slow motion crash. 15 years ago, I made a source-to-sea journey down the Colorado River for National Geographic. The point was to photograph the river's natural beauty, but also the many uses diminishing its flow. The river's plumbing network fills sprinklers and faucets from Denver to Las Vegas to San Diego and every other major Southwest city, town, farm field, and feedlot in between. Along the way, I learned for the first time that thanks to an outdated Colorado Compact, a century-old management agreement that expires this year, we allocate more water than the river actually supplies. The Colorado does not reach the sea anymore. It did for 6 million years, but it ran dry sometime in the late 1990s. Why? Simply put, there are too many straws in the drink. On top of that, in the past 2.5 decades, drought and a changing climate have cut about 20% of the flow. Tree ring science confirms the river's lower average annual flows also shows the American Southwest is facing its driest period in 1,200 years. So, the system is veering toward catastrophe. America's two largest reservoirs, Lake Powell and Lake Mead, bookend the Grand Canyon. Depleted by nearly 80%, they're approaching dead pool when water levels drop below the level of the outlets in the dams. For years, the phrase was used for futuristic, alarmist forecasts. Now the Bureau of Reclamation says that under worst-case hydrologic models, Lake Powell could see it next year. The compact among the parties that share the waters of the Colorado expires at the end of this year. Everyone agrees changes need to be made, but disputes over where and how have created gridlock between the Upper Basin Mountain states, Colorado, Utah, Wyoming, New Mexico, and the Lower Basin, Nevada, Arizona, California. The tension is so visceral that the state water leaders have refused to all sit at one table. Band-aid has been laid on top of Band-aid. Temporary solutions invariably fail. Native communities, which hold paper rights to 25% of the river's water, have remained overlooked and waterless. While habitats dry up, big agriculture, largest straw in the river, continues to divert millions of acre feet to grow 10 to 15 cuttings of alfalfa crops a year for export to Saudi Arabia and China. Last April, I journeyed downstream to Lake Powell, where water levels at 28% were close to record low. I was documenting the newly visible arches, alcoves, and alleyways of Glen Canyon, which for grandeur can rival or surpass parts of the Grand Canyon. Sandstone wonders like Cathedral in the Desert that had been underwater for my entire lifetime were now returning, stained with sediment bathtub rings from wetter times, they remind us of our hubris. At the end of my trip, I spoke with a boat attendant at Bullfrog Marina who was bemoaning the challenges facing the recreation industry. Less water, lower visitor counts, fewer boat rentals. But as I left, she pointed east and said hopefully, "We're just waiting for the snow melt to arrive." Last winter's snowpack started out well below average, then rallied in April, spiking to 97% of average based on 30-year data. But that late winter arrival did not all reach the river. Instead, higher than normal spring temperatures created thirsty soil that soaked up nearly half the flow. So that hopeful runoff never came to Lake Powell or beyond to Lake Mead, both of which shrank further. By May, the runoff was so anemic the creek my family uses to irrigate a grass hay meadow nearly ran dry. On the cool morning of May 31, typically high water runoff time, the water commissioner called me to say we had to turn off our ditch. Someone downstream with older water rights did not have enough water to fill theirs. This was a first both for me and for the 88-year-old water commissioner who'd held the job for decades. Neither of us had ever seen the creek run so low, nor hear of a call on any historic ditch in our region. When my brother and I shut the headgate, we relocated some brook trout from an eddy in the ditch back to the creek. There was not water for both. As I approached the final leg of my source-to-sea journey on the Colorado, my raft ran aground. I was just over the border with Mexico. Even as I absorbed the shock that I had to walk the last 90 miles, it did not cross my mind the shortfall would become evident on our ranch in the Colorado's headwaters, 8,000 feet above sea level. But here we are. As I began writing this in mid-January, Colorado snowpack was just over 50% of annual average. As my neighbor, a former Olympic ski racer who knows something about snow, said to me, "We have to accept that winter is just not happening. Like it or not, she's right. And as a result, we are bathing in a basin-wide water crisis. The civilization we built around an outdated water management model is proving when we ask too much of a limited resource, it disappears. It's time for those in charge of managing this resource that produces over 12% of U.S. GDP to start thinking bigger, beyond their states and regional water districts. It's time to face their differences, head to the river shores, and literally climb on a raft to take a river trip together. The Colorado River manager should get in a boat in the headwaters somewhere, Shoshona Rapid in Colorado, or below Flaming Gorge Dam in Utah, and keep floating downstream till they figure something out, not just how to stretch less water, but how to fund infrastructure that sustains it. If they took the time to listen and look at the actual river and work together pulling paddles and oars, they might find some answers downstream. I bet they would not only reconnect with the river they manage, but also find more solutions than by avoiding each other in sterile conference rooms. 5.5 decades ago, two Colorado River nemeses, Floyd Dominey of the Bureau of Reclamation, Pro-Dam, and David Brower of the Sierra Club, Anti-Dam, famously did just that. They took a river trip together. and while they did not come out as friends, they did share drinks on the river's banks at night, crash through rapids together, return with a respect for each other, and a renewed love for the river itself. Who knows if that trip was key to fewer dams on the river today, but those fierce adversaries shared more river time than our leaders do today. I have witnessed firsthand how different user groups can collaborate to keep this river running and even briefly water its parched delta. Rafters, ranchers, anglers, hydrologists, energy wonks, government officials, others have coordinated to keep water in the river. I still think state water managers can as well. Trump's war, under the heading Politics, the President's Massive Gamble in the Middle East by Eric Cortalesa. Eric Cortalesa is the primary author. There are also reports by Brian Bennett, Leslie Dickstein, and Simone Shaw. This is a lengthy article, which I will abridge. President Donald Trump had just arrived at Mar-a-Lago Friday night, February 27, when he got word from U.S. intelligence officials. They believed they had located Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. Months had passed since Trump began preparing for the possibility of war with Iran. In recent weeks, he'd instructed military officials to draw up operational plans for a joint strike, coordinated closely with Israel. 8 months after bombing three Iranian nuclear sites, he was once again getting edgy about the Islamic Republic's nuclear program. The latest round of negotiations in Geneva had done little to reassure him. Trump was suspicious that Tehran was preparing an attack on American and Israeli targets. Though the U.S. had positioned a carrier strike group in the region with another on its way, Iranian negotiators showed little urgency to reach a deal. He notes, proposing to meet again in a week with U.S. envoys. When I heard that, Trump says, I said, you know, they're going to hit first. Guests partied on one side of his oceanfront mansion and private club, and Trump huddled with top military and intelligence brass on the other, where he made the decision to launch a decapitation strike against the Iranian regime. We went way early, Trump explains in a March 4 phone call with Time. We were going to do it in another week. In the early hours of Saturday morning, the start of the work week in Tehran, Operation Epic Fury began. American long-range missiles and drones moved in concert with Israeli jets, striking hundreds of Iranian military installations, missile batteries, naval vessels, air defense systems, and command centers. It was one of the region's most expansive air operations in decades. The bombardment killed Khamenei, who presided over a repressive regime for 36 years. Also dead were a cluster of senior Iranian officials envisioned as potential successors. I've killed all their leaders, Trump says. That room's gone. The attacks also inflicted significant damage to civilian areas. In the far south of Iran, more than 150 people were killed when a barrage hit a girls' school. Iran retaliated with missile and drone bombardments against U.S. bases and allied territory, targeting military facilities across the Gulf, including Ul Udeid Air Base in Qatar. One Iranian drone killed six American service members at a U.S. command center in Kuwait. Asked whether Americans should be worried about retaliatory attacks at home, Trump acknowledges the possibility. I guess, he says, but I think they're worried about all the time. I think they're worried about that all the time. We think about it all the time. We plan for it. But yeah, you know, we expect some things. Like I said, some people will die when you go to war. Some people will die. Trump promised to end wars, not start them. Instead, he's deployed military force in increasingly dizzying ways. No other modern American leader has directed assaults in as many countries in such a short span of time. Since returning to office, Trump has authorized attacks in eight nations, three of which have never before been directly targeted by U.S. forces. In 2025 alone, he approved more individual airstrikes than his predecessor did over 4 years. Trump has ordered a major campaign of airstrikes targeting Houthi-controlled areas in Yemen, authorized naval attacks on vessels from Venezuela suspected of drug trafficking, signed off on the operation that seized that country's authoritarian president, Nicolas Maduro, left more than 100 dead, and placed the Venezuelan leader on trial in New York. Just days after the onslaught against Tehran, the U.S. took part in joint military operations in Ecuador, targeting designated terrorist organizations. His administration has also fixed its sights on Cuba, where President Miguel Díaz-Canel has ramped up military exercises amid reports Trump has asked advisors to devise plans to end the island's six-decade communist rule. In short, if Trump campaigned as a president of peace, he's governed as the opposite. Now he's drawn the U.S. into the kind of conflict he long pledged to avoid. Having ousted the tyrannical ruler of Iran's theocracy, he's committed the U.S. anew to regime change in the Middle East, telling Time he intends to play a role in shaping the next government of a regional powerhouse home to some 90 million people. One of the things I'm going to be asking for is the ability to work with them on choosing a new leader, he says. I'm not going through this to end up with another Khomeini. I want to be involved in the selection. They can select, but we have to make sure it's somebody that's reasonable to the United States. It's impossible to know how all this will unfold. There was little sympathy internationally for the Ayatollah, who reigned over a brutal Islamist regime throughout the Tehran and throughout Tehran and across the Iranian diaspora. Crowds have rejoiced in the streets upon hearing the news of his demise. To some, Trump's attacks are historic, in the best sense, eliminating an avowed adversary who sought to destroy the U.S. and whom Washington has long viewed as the head of the world's foremost state sponsor of terrorism. But the gambit carries extraordinary risks for Trump's presidency, for Iran's fragile political future, for regional stability, for the safety of Americans home and abroad. The gravest decision a president can make is whether to send American troops into harm's way. Trump, who once defined himself in opposition to foreign entanglements, has pivoted with astonishing alacrity toward open-ended confrontation across multiple theaters. In his interview with Time, Trump says his goals are to eliminate Iran's nuclear threat once and for all, to dismantle its ballistic missile program, to install a Western-friendly government. We have to be able to deal with sane and rational people, he says. Yet Trump launched a war before making a case to the country or to Congress, and his administration has often offered unclear and at times contradictory explanations of the mission's objectives. The most unnerving possibility is that Operation Epic Fury is not the culmination of his shift toward a war presidency, but rather the beginning of a new chapter. Reaction inside Iran, jubilation quickly followed by apprehension, by K. Armin Serjoy, with reporting by Roxana Saberi and Fatima Jamalpour. In Tehran, the war found a contractor named Salman. As he was toweling off, I had just stepped out of the shower, he said, getting prepared to go out when the sound of low-flying aircraft startled me. Out his window, he saw two columns of black smoke above the compound of Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. It had been hit in the first wave of U.S.-Israeli airstrikes. When his death was confirmed, celebrations broke out across the country. I feel a trembling inside me, a feeling I've never experienced in my life, said Mehdi, an engineer in the eastern city of Mashhad. I think this may be the most important moment of my life. Someone has died who killed all my dreams. It's as if I'm dreaming, said Hassan, 41, a Tehran lawyer. The worry that the regime might not fall even after his death keeps me from being fully happy, but I keep reminding myself nothing was more terrifying than him being alive. In a video message, President Donald Trump urged Iranians to stay inside while U.S. and Israeli forces carried out their assault. When we're finished, take over your government, he said. It will be yours to take. Hearing that, a 47-year-old Tehran businessman named Mohsen unpacked the car he was about to take his family away in. When I heard Trump say, stay in your homes and take over the country when he's finished, I changed my mind. How can I go onto the streets if I'm not in Tehran? Before the week was out, however, events had tempered the initial enthusiasm of some. After the massacre of thousands of protesters in January, Sorour, who works as a clerk in Tehran, welcomed the assault as the only way we can get rid of this regime. Then she found herself parked at a gas station when an airstrike destroyed the building beside it. As soon as I got out, I slipped. I looked down, and I saw I was standing in the spilled-out guts of a motorcyclist who'd been filling up. She found bits of flesh and brain in her hair and now showers compulsively. The number one thing we need to do now, she says, is fight the Americans and Israelis. Others reached by time were alarmed by news reports that the CIA is arming militias in Iran's Kurdish minority, some of which harbor separatist aspirations. For years, the regime used this as a pretext to frighten people and to prevent them from rising up, notes Behrouz, an engineer in Tehran. Only during the nationwide solidarity of the 2022 protests over the death of Mahsa Amini did people realize that this is just regime propaganda, he says. I cannot imagine how dumb Trump and Netanyahu have to be to prove the Islamic Republic right. For Heshmat, 42, a Tehran businessman, the threat was visceral. The first thing these Kurdish militia would do is start massacring Iran's Turks in Azerbaijan province, he said. I'm originally from Tabriz. My family's still mostly there. We have to defend our family, and honestly, I don't think it would be possible without getting hold of arms. Iran's borders include a host of other ethnic minorities as well. If the Kurdish militia attack, it's not going to stop in the Kurdish region, said Behrouz. Soon the Turks will also rise up, then the Baloch, then the Arabs. Iran will disintegrate. I've been fighting the Islamic Republic for many years. I've been doing all I can to get rid of them, because that's the only way we can have a free Iran, a democratic Iran. But the perquisite to all these things is that there is an Iran, that it exists. Obituary, A Life of Sanctimony and Violence, by Carl Vick. The years did not mellow Ali Khamenei, appointed supreme leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran at age 50. He was the longest-serving ruler in the Middle East at the time of his death at 86 on February 28, 2026. The Islamic Republic had been founded by his mentor, Ruhollah Khomeini, the Grand Ayatollah, who, after the 1979 revolution, replaced a monarchy with a theocracy. But it was Khomeini who ruled for three-quarters of the republic's existence, transforming it into a de facto military dictatorship. Sometimes clothes do make the man. Khomeini wore the turban of a senior Shiite cleric, but the pale plaid kerchief often looped around his neck was favored by the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, IRGC. The Praetorian force he elevated to near co-ruler status. By the early 2000s, the guards had consolidated military, political, and economic power so extensively that a prominent Iranian economist remarked with raised eyebrows that the only comparison was to National Socialism in 1930s Germany. If that arrangement solidified Khomeini's rule, it left little for Iran's 93 million people, and even less after the regime's pursuit of a nuclear weapon triggered intensifying international sanctions that sent the economy into free fall at the end of 2025. With hard currency reserves depleted and inflation soaring, Iranians took to the streets en masse, chanting for the regime's downfall. On Khomeini's orders, security forces killed an estimated 30,000 people, according to senior health officials. Over the following 2 months, President Trump opened negotiations over Iran's nuclear program while deploying 2 aircraft carrier groups and additional war planes to the region, the largest U.S. military buildup there since the 2003 invasion of Iraq, an armada that was finally unleashed on Iran in the early hours of February 28. Iran's supreme leader was killed that morning in the opening barrage as a joint U.S. and Israeli aerial assault targeted military and government sites across the country. Trump confirmed the death in a post on Truth Social, writing, "Khomeini, one of the most evil people in history, is dead." For decades, Khomeini had sought to defy both the U.S., the great Satan, leading a godless West, and Israel, while adhering to an overriding imperative, preserve the regime at all costs. That imperative may explain why in his later years he spent extended periods underground. The bunker beneath his compound in central Tehran lies so deep that one visitor timed the elevator descent at more than 5 minutes. After June 2025, when Israel for 12 days and the U.S. for 1 launched strikes aimed at crippling Iran's nuclear program and decapitating the IRGC leadership, Khomeini curtailed public appearances. He stopped holding regular meetings with Iran's elected president and emerged only for defiant speeches in controlled environments. An aircraft carrier is a dangerous machine, he acknowledged in a February 17 speech, but even more dangerous than that is the weapon capable of sending it to the bottom of the sea. The son of a cleric, Khomeini grew up in modest circumstances in the eastern city of Mashhad. As a religious student, he gravitated toward Shiite thinkers who fused political absolutism with theology. He became that unlikely figure, a militant cleric. During the 1960s and 1970s, he endured torture and solitary confinement in the prisons of the U.S.-backed Shah, whose overthrow became the central project of his youth. After the Islamic Revolution, as a key aide to Khomeini, he rose quickly. In 1981, as he was about to address a news conference, a bomb planted by a rival faction exploded beside him, leaving his dominant right hand effectively useless and him in chronic pain. Months later, when Iran's president, Mohammad Ali Rajai, and 99 others were killed in another bombing, Khomeini was chosen as his successor. In his inaugural address, he denounced deviation, liberalism, and American-influenced leftists, previewing a tenure defined by ideological rigidity. When Khomeini died in 1989, shortly after accepting a ceasefire in the 8-year war with Iraq to preserve the regime, he said, there was no clear successor. Khamenei, recently returned from a trip to North Korea and China, was only a junior cleric in a Shiite tradition noted for its adherence to hierarchy. But a battlefield promotion to Ayatollah was arranged, blending faith with politics, in an exercise that critics said sullied both, even before Khamenei reinforced his position by earthly means, elevating the IRGC. On state television, Khamenei projected an avuncular demeanor, his spectacles framing a sharp gaze. Visiting journalists were informed that his favorite novel was Les Miserables, and that in a sclerotic theocracy, his wristwatch signaled modern tastes. But when delivering Friday sermons, he rested his good hand on the barrel of a rifle. In the 1990s, Iranian voters expressed their appetite for relief from the strictures of fundamentalist rule by voting overwhelmingly to elect reformist figures to the presidency and parliament, the parts of government that operate below the upper tiers controlled by unelected clerics. Khamenei moved to contain it. Over time, newspapers were closed, dissidents jailed, candidates kept off the ballot. At one point, Khamenei ordered the beating of his own brother, a cleric aligned with reform. After the disputed 2009 presidential election, in which an apparent reformist victory was thwarted, the streets became the only outlet for dissent. By all accounts, Khamenei lived modestly, yet a 2013 Reuters investigation estimated he controlled assets worth $95 billion through a network of foundations and holdings. In a country where a government ministry reported in 2023 that more than half the population was malnourished, such figures fueled resentment. Bloomberg reported in January that his 56-year-old son, Mojtaba, long viewed as a potential successor, owned more than $100 million in luxury properties abroad. The IRGC controls roughly 30% of Iran's economy, according to one of its founders, Mohsen Sazagara, now an exiled dissident. When a new airport opened outside Tehran in 2004, the guards asserted control by rolling tanks onto its runways. Its members dominate major sectors of industry and oversee Iran's vast smuggling networks. Over time, power in the Islamic Republic operated like that of a royal court. Khamenei married before the revolution to a woman whose photograph and even first name were not made public till her own death, March 2, which an official news agency attributed to injuries sustained in the airstrike that also killed her husband. The marriages of their children and siblings were widely known, however, doubling as alliances into political factions, the clerical hierarchy, and the unelected institutions that ultimately answered to the supreme leader. Karim Sajapour of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, who has written extensively on Khamenei, said he governed Iran as a cause, not a country. Historically known as Persia, the country has endured for more than 2,500 years. The cause, however, has been hurting. Despite years of reports about his declining health, Khamenei did not publicly designate a successor. He was said to have regarded Qasem Soleimani, charismatic IRGC general, as a son, however. Until President Trump ordered his killing in a 2020 drone strike, Soleimani was in charge of Iran's sprawling network of proxy forces, extending from Iraq to Syria, Yemen, Gaza, and Lebanon, where Hezbollah long held Israel in a stalemate. But every node of what Khamenei called the axis of resistance was severely weakened after the October 7, 2023 attack on Israel, The attack, which killed some 1,200 people, was carried out by Hamas, a Tehran client that expected help from others. That help came only fitfully, however, while Israel mounted a series of campaigns that, after decimating Hezbollah and the missile arsenal it threatened to unleash over the border if Israel dared to attack Tehran, left Iran exposed. Also gone by the time of Khamenei's death, enforcement of the Islamic Republic's strict dress code for women, regarded as a pillar of the regime, its last remaining alliance with Venezuela. Physical access to oil markets cut off by a U.S. naval blockade, and perhaps most consequentially, the country's air defenses destroyed in the 12-day war. The question now is whether the regime survives the death of its master. From Time Off Television, essay, two new comedies loosen up about sex on campus by Judy Berman, and this will be abridged for time constraints. In the series premiere of Netflix's Vladimir, Rachel Weisz awakens from troubled sleep to a cascade of texts and addresses the camera with pleading eyes. "All I want is a life free of complications," says her unnamed lead. "If I cannot have power, can I at least be free from other people's drama? Free from their behavior, free from their needs and desires." It feels appropriate that "free" appears four times in this monologue. The character is a blocked novelist who teaches English at a liberal arts college, and there's no setting more emblematic of freedom and its discontents than the campus, where tenure protects the intellectual liberty of faculty and students live independently for the first time. Among the most common school mottos is "Veritas vos libera, liberabit," "the truth will set you free." If only we could agree on what constitutes freedom or truth, because we never have. Higher education has always been a battleground. Protest has defined academia for generations, but perhaps the longest-running conflict within higher ed surrounds freedom as it's practiced on campus. Should free speech be an absolute right, even if it's false or hurtful? Should faculty and students be free to interact in any way they choose, including sexually? These questions are not new to fiction, but storytellers, many of whom, including Vladimir's creator and the author of the novel it's based on, Julia May Jonas, also teach, have paid them particular attention of late. Since the Me Too movement seemingly shifted the balance of power on campus, books like Mary Adkins' Privilege, movies like After the Hunt, and TV series like The Chair have measured the ramifications when students call out teachers for misconduct. These stories lean tragic. The accused, the accuser, maybe a complicit bystander, come out worse than they went in. Vladimir and HBO's Rooster, which both debuted in March, break that pattern. Though stylistically dissimilar, each is a true comedy that finds humor in how sex scandals destabilize earnest, insular academic communities. And each dares to honor the humanity in characters often reduced to predators and prey, shrill social justice warriors, and brave free thinkers. The nuance is refreshing but oddly timed, as though it took unprecedented government interference with freedoms taken for granted on campus for those inside their walls to give each other grace. Rape is not funny, so it helps that neither show strains to make it so. These liaisons are consensual but fraught by infidelity, power disparities, shifting norms. Rooster's less a satire of academia than it is a workplace comedy in the mold of co-showrunner Bill Lawrence's recent hits Ted Lasso and Shrinking. As in those sitcoms, our hero is a single, aimless, middle-aged dad. This flawed man is also kind and generous, fostering a community of blunderers, helping each other become better people. Rooster puts a more prestige-coated spin on the Lawrence formula. A timid author who has yet to recover from his divorce, protagonist Greg channels his fantasies into pulpy bestsellers. Lawrence and co-showrunner Matt Tarsi's poke friendly fun at progressive sexual mores. It will change the stories we set within easily lampooned groves of academe and make shows like these feel like relics of a more innocent time. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine, which is generously supported by G. Suggs Insurance, a SureVest insurance group company. They can be reached at gsuggsinsurance.com. We hope you enjoyed listening. Please join us next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.